900 years ago, has been located and analyzed in the Andes of northwestern Venezuela. The black mat refers to possible fallout from the Encke comet airburst presumed to have occurred over the Laurentide ice sheet, the impact spreading ejecta over large portions of North America and Europe, making it an interhemispheric event of considerable magnitude. The presence of copious monazite in the carbonaceous coatings is considered part of the incoming ejecta, as it is not a common indicator mineral in the local lithology. The intergrowth of carbonaceous black mat material with thermally disrupted and fragmented quartz and feldspar, a welded patina of 100 to 400 nanometers in thickness, could only have occurred with temperatures in excess of 900 degrees centigrade, the event here interpreted to be of cosmogenic origin. 2011, framboidal iron oxide, chondrite-like material from the black mat, Murray Springs, Arizona. At the end of the Pleistocene, a younger Dryas black mat was deposited on top of the Pleistocene sediments in many parts of North America. A study of the magnetic fraction from the basal section of the black mat at Murray Springs, Arizona, revealed the presence of amorphous iron oxide framboids in a glassy iron silica matrix. Our data suggest that the observed textures are due to a shock event that fractured and largely amorphized the grains. Therefore, we argue that these particles are the product of a hypervelocity impact event. 2012. Evidence from central Mexico supporting the Younger Dryas extraterrestrial impact hypothesis. We report the discovery in Lake Cuitzeo in central Mexico of a black carbon-rich lacustrine layer containing nanodiamonds, microspherules, and other unusual materials that date to the early Younger Dryas. We find the evidence cannot be explained by any known terrestrial mechanism. It is, however, consistent with the Younger Dryas boundary impact hypothesis, postulating a major extraterrestrial impact involving multiple airbursts and/or ground impacts at 12,900 years ago. 2012. Very high temperature impact melt products as evidence for cosmic airbursts and impacts 12,900 years ago. We examined sediment sequences from 18 dated Younger Dryas Boundary YDB sites across three continents. All sites display abundant microspherules in the YDB, with none or few above and below. In addition, three sites display vesicular, high-temperature, siliceous scoria-like objects, or SLOs, that match the spherules geochemically. Our observations indicate that YDB objects are similar to material produced in nuclear airbursts, impact crater plumes and cosmic airbursts, and strongly support the hypothesis of multiple cosmic airbursts impacts at 12,900 years ago. Data presented here require that thermal radiation from air shocks was sufficient to melt surface sediments at temperatures up to or greater than the boiling point of quartz, 2,200 degrees centigrade. 2013, large PT anomaly in the Greenland ice core points to a cataclysm at the onset of Younger Dryas. One explanation of the abrupt cooling episode known as the Younger Dryas, YD, is a cosmic impact or airburst at the YD boundary that triggered cooling and resulted in other calamities. We tested the YD impact hypothesis by analyzing ice samples from the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2, GISP2, ice core across the Bolling-Alerod YD boundary for major and trace elements. We found a large platinum PT anomaly at the YDB. Circumstantial evidence hints at an extraterrestrial source, perhaps a metal impactor with an unusual composition. 2013, new evidence from a black mat site in the northern Andes supporting a cosmic impact 12,800 years ago. The spherules from Venezuela are morphologically and compositionally identical to YDB spherules documented elsewhere on three continents, North America, Europe, and Asia, confirming the YDB magnetic spherule results of previous researchers. Their microstructural texturing indicates they formed from melting and rapid quenching. Thus, the most likely origin of the spherules seems to be by cosmic impact airburst 12,800 years ago, with interhemispheric consequences. The site in Venezuela, along with one in Peru, are the two southernmost sites currently known to display evidence for the YDB impact event, and these sites represent the first evidence that the effects of the impact event extended into South America and even into the Southern Hemisphere. 2014. Nanodiamond-rich layer across three continents consistent with major cosmic impact at 12,800 Carl BP. A major cosmic impact event has been proposed at the onset of the Younger Dryas cooling episode at 12,800 years, plus or minus 150 years before the present, forming the Younger Dryas boundary, YDB layer, distributed across up to 50 million square kilometers on four continents, in 24 dated stratigraphic sections in 10 countries of the Northern Hemisphere. The YDB layer contains a clearly defined abundance peak in nanodiamonds, NDs, a major cosmic impact proxy. The large body of evidence now obtained about YDB NDs is strongly consistent with an origin by cosmic impact around 12,800 years ago, and is inconsistent with formation of YDB ND by natural terrestrial processes, including wildfires, anthropogenesis, and/or influx of cosmic dust. Note this paper and its important implications will be discussed in more detail later in this chapter. Taking on the dogmatic uniformitarians. One would have thought, with such an impressive accumulation of evidence, that the Younger Dryas impact theory would by now be fully accepted, and that researchers would have moved on to a broader consideration of the implications of such a recent and hitherto unsuspected global cataclysm for our understanding of the history of the Earth and of our own species. However, we've already seen from the example of J. Harlan Brett's how scientists wedded to the uniformitarian and gradualist reference frame react with extreme negative force to catastrophist theories. Nor was Brett's an exception. Alfred Wegener, who first proposed the notion of continental drift, plate tectonics, was similarly pilloried, as subsequently were Lewis and Walter Alvarez, the Chicxulub KT impact, Stephen J. Gould, punctuated equilibrium, Victor Klube and Bill Napier, coherent catastrophism, and James Lovelock, Sherwood Rowland, Mario Molina, and Lynn Margulis for their contributions to geophysiology and the Gaia theory. It should come as no surprise, therefore, that Richard Firestone, Alan West, James Kennett, and others who have followed the evidence and stuck their necks out to suggest that a comet impact caused the Younger Dryas have also come under sustained and bitter attack. Indeed, the triumphant crowing of critics who clearly believe they have done away once and for all with the heretical catastrophism of Firestone, West, and Kennett has filled the academic air several times in the past few years. On each occasion, you can almost hear the collective sigh of relief as if to say, "Thank God, we finally got those bastards." But then a few months later comes the devastating and absolutely convincing refutation that forces the critics back to the drawing board. This is why 8 years of sustained attacks have only served to prove again and again that the science behind the theory of the Younger Dryas comet is good. It's quite noticeable, reviewing the literature, that academics form themselves into gangs. The ringleaders in the anti-YD comet camp, whose names appear frequently at the top of critical articles, include Mark Boslow, a physicist on the technical staff of Sandia National Laboratories, and Nicholas Pinter, a geology professor at Southern Illinois University. In 2012, they teamed up with half a dozen other scientists to publish a paper entitled "Arguments and Evidence Against a Younger Dryas Impact Event." And a year earlier, Pinter and some of the authors of the 2012 attack had joined forces to write a paper hubristically entitled "The Younger Dryas Impact Hypothesis, a Requiem." To paraphrase Mark Twain, reports of the death of the comet theory have been greatly exaggerated. For example, one of the key critiques made by Boslow et al. In their 2012 article was that magnetic microspherule abundance results published by the impact proponents have not been reproducible by other workers. Analysis of the same YD site stratigraphy by Suraval et al., 2009, could not replicate observations for two of the impact markers published by Firestone et al., 2007. The study by Suraval et al., 2009, found no peaks of abundance unique to the YD time interval. But the impact proponents were later able to show that Boslow and his co-authors neglected to cite 9 independent spherule studies on 2 continents that reported finding significant YDB spherule abundances. More damning, though, was the fact that when other scientists repeated the analysis of Sourival et al., their findings did indeed support an impact. The scientists concluded that the inability of Sourival et al. To find YDB spherule peaks resulted from not adhering to the prescribed extraction protocol. For example, Sourival et al. Did not conduct any analyses using scanning electron microscopy, a necessary procedure clearly specified by Firestone et al. A second independent study by Malcolm A. Lecomte et al. Noted that Sourival et al. Collected and analyzed samples from 7 YDB sites purportedly using the same protocol as Firestone et al., but did not find a single spherule in YDB sediments at 2 previously reported sites. Lecomte et al. Set out to examine this discrepancy. After a thorough investigation of all the evidence, their results cast the work of Sourival et al. Into an even deeper shadow. We conducted an independent blind investigation of 2 sites common to both studies, and a 3rd site investigated only by Sourival et al. We found abundant YDB microspherules at all 3 widely separated sites, consistent with the results of Firestone et al., and conclude that the analytical protocol employed by Sourival et al. Deviated significantly from that of Firestone et al. Morphological and geochemical analysis of YDB spherules suggest they formed from abrupt melting and quenching of terrestrial materials and are consistent with a previously proposed cosmic impact 12,900 years ago. Unsurprisingly, after all this, Pinter's requiem for the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis turned out to have been premature. Pinter et al. Claimed to have sampled the YDB layer at a location identical or nearly identical with the location reported by Kennett et al. As part of 3 studies that reported finding no YDB spherules or nanodiamonds. However, the published Universal Transverse Mercator coordinates reveal that their purported continuous sequence is actually 4 discontinuous sections. These locations range in distance from the site investigated by Kennett et al. By 7,000 meters, 1,600 meters, 165 meters, and 30 meters, clearly showing that they did not sample the YDB site of Kennett et al. Furthermore, this sampling strategy raises questions about whether Pinter et al. Sampled the YDB at all, and may explain why they were unable to find peaks in YDB magnetic spherules, carbon spherules, or nanodiamonds. In 2012-13, in an effort to limit the scope for poor or misleading scholarship to be cited as though it discredits their work when in fact it does no such thing, Jim Kennett, Richard Firestone, Alan West, and a formidable group of pro-impact scientists launched one of the most comprehensive investigations of spherules ever undertaken. The investigation focused on 18 sites across North America, Europe, and the Middle East, the latter represented by Abu Huraira in Syria, and conducted more than 700 analyses on spherules using energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy for chemical analysis and scanning electron microscopy for surface microstructural characterization. The results, published in PNAS on the 4th of June 2013, took advantage of recent advances in radiocarbon technology to refine the date of the Younger Dryas impact from 12,900 to 12,800 years ago, and enabled a much more detailed map of the YDB field to be drawn up, covering close to 50 million square kilometers of North, Central, and South America, a large segment of the Atlantic Ocean, and most of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. Calculations indicate that the impact deposited around 10 million tons of spherules across this vast strewn field. Nor was there any doubt in the researchers' minds that an impact had been at the heart of the matter. The analysis of 771 YDB objects presented in this paper strongly support a major cosmic impact at 12,800 years ago. Spherules are 1. Widespread at 18 sites on 4 continents, 2. Display large abundance peaks only at the YD onset at around 12,800 years ago, 3. Are rarely found above or below the YDB, indicating a rare event, and 4. Amount to an estimated 10 million tons of materials distributed across 50 million square kilometers of several continents, thus precluding a small, local event. Despite the annoying ability of the Younger Dryas comet to keep on proving itself, and of its proponents to keep on refuting all attacks, Nicholas Pinter, lead author of the 2011 Requiem paper, felt moved in an interview with NBC News in September 2013 once again to attempt to cast the hypothesis into scientific limbo. "My only comment," he said, "is that the pro-impact literature is at this point fringe science being promoted by a single journal." A number of observers with no particular axe of their own to grind were puzzled by this remark. First of all, as National Geographic correspondent Robert Kunzig noted, it smacked a little of wishful thinking, even desperation on Pinter's part. "Some opponents of the hypothesis," wrote Kunzig, "want so badly for it to go away that they've attempted to declare it dead." Secondly, the journal that Pinter accused of promoting fringe science was none other than the revered, utterly mainstream, and extensively peer-reviewed Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS. Thirdly, although a number of articles by Kennett West Firestone and their team have appeared in PNAS, it is simply not true to suggest that PNAS is promoting their cause. On the contrary, at the time Pinter blurted out his protest to NBC, the critics of the YD comet hypothesis had published 10 times in PNAS, whereas the proponents of the hypothesis had published there only 8 times. Likewise, Pinter's claim that the hypothesis is only being presented in a single journal could hardly be more wrong. By September 2013, in addition to their 8 papers in PNAS, proponents had published no less than 15 papers in 13 other journals. The scholarly fight over the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis is far from over. At the time of writing, the most recent salvo fired by critics of the hypothesis was entitled "Anthropogenic Origin of Siliceous Scoria Droplets from Pleistocene and Holocene Archaeological Sites in Northern Syria," authored by P. Tai, G. Wilcox, G. H. Barford, and D. Q. Fuller. It was published online on 16 December 2014 and in print in January 2015 in the Journal of Archaeological Science. The essence of the argument in this paper is that siliceous scoria droplets, composed mostly of glass matrix and bubbles together with partially melted mineral grains from Abu Huraira in Syria, cited by pro-impact scientists as evidence for their case, were nothing to do with the comet, but were instead a product of ancient buildings destroyed by house fires. "We therefore conclude that melting of building earth in ancient settlements can occur during fires reaching modest temperatures. There is no evidence to suggest that siliceous scoria droplets result from very high temperature melting of soil and are the result of a cosmic event." For the Syria site, the impact theory is out, boasted lead author Peter Tai in a press interview headlined "Study Casts Doubt on Mammoth-Killing Cosmic Impact." But once again, it seems the bluster was premature. Alan West is listed as the corresponding author on the majority of scholarly papers published by the team of scientists working on the Younger Dryas impact, so I emailed him on the 18th of March 2015 to ask if he and his colleagues had any response to the critique by Tai et al. West replied as follows. "We agree with Tai et al. That hut fires can produce glass, but it does not follow, therefore, that all glass comes from hut fires, as they conclude. We have analyzed natural glasses supplied by one of the authors of that study, and the 12,800-year-old glass from Syria is only superficially similar. Instead, it matches known cosmic impact glass, as well as high-temperature atomic bomb glass." Most importantly, those authors did not discuss or look for the evidence of abundant high-temperature minerals presented in our previous papers on 3 sites on 2 continents: Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and Syria, where we found suicide that melts at 2,300 degrees centigrade and corundum at around 1,800 degrees centigrade. Now we have even stronger evidence from the Syrian site and are working on a new paper to be published this year. The 12,800-year-old Syrian glass contains a range of minerals that melted at extraordinarily high temperatures. Those temperatures are sufficient to melt steel. Furthermore, the same glass-rich layer at the Syrian site contains large peaks in nanodiamonds, nickel, and platinum. No building fire can duplicate that range of evidence. Such fires can't produce nanodiamonds or platinum enrichments. All this evidence refutes the hypothesis of Tai et al. That this glass was produced in low-temperature building fires. When the new paper by West and his colleagues is published later in 2015, after this book has gone to press, I have no doubt that it will effectively refute the arguments of Tai et al., just as all previous attacks have been successfully refuted. But I also have no doubt that others, who for whatever reasons of their own are philosophically opposed to the notion of a cataclysm 12,800 years ago, will publish yet more so-called requiems for the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis in the years ahead, even while the constant discovery of new evidence means that it continues to thrive and grow. As we've seen throughout this book, catastrophist ideas, no matter how thoroughly documented and persistently argued and presented they may be, are routinely and regularly brushed under the carpet by the uniformitarian establishment. Thus, while he lacked nothing in persistence or in the thoroughness of his documentation, J. Harlan Bretz faced years of discouragement before his ideas were welcomed by the mainstream. Jim Kennett, Richard Firestone, Alan West and their colleagues have argued the catastrophist case for the Younger Dryas comet impact with equally commendable persistence and with equal mastery of documentation, and they too have faced rejection and hostility. Two things are different in their case, however. First, this is the 21st century and we have the internet, which allows the very rapid sharing and proliferation of ideas. That was not the case when Bretz began his lonely struggle. Secondly, Kennett, Firestone, and West seem to have a better understanding of the politics of science than Bretz did, and have greatly strengthened their own hand by mobilizing support for their work from many colleagues. It is one thing to shout down and silence a lone wolf like Bretz. It is quite another to shout down and silence a large team of highly credentialed scientists from multiple disciplines and universities. And the team is growing. As I complete this chapter in March 2015, I have before me on my desk the latest paper published by Firestone, Kennett and West. The paper, entitled Nanodiamond-Rich Layer Across Three Continents Consistent with Major Cosmic Impact 12,800 Years Ago, appears in the September 2014 issue of the Journal of Geology. The lead author is Charles R. Kinsey of the Department of Chemistry, DePaul University, Chicago. Firestone, Kennett, West, and 22 other leading scientists from prestigious universities and research institutes around the world are co-authors. The gravity of the paper, of its authors, and of the journal in which it appears, together with the further detailed refutations it contains of prior critiques, combine to make a laughingstock of Nicholas Pinter's claim that the Younger Dryas comet hypothesis is fringe science. Indeed, the contrary is true. What is clearly happening is that an extraordinary hypothesis has again and again met the demand for extraordinary evidence to support it, and has begun to force its way through the staunchly defended doors of the mainstream. It will not be an easy struggle. It never is. There will be setbacks as well as progress, but the 2013 paper on spherules and the 2014 paper on nanodiamonds contains a wealth of evidence that even the most hardened gradualists must find hard to dismiss entirely. As Wallace Broker, a geochemist and climate scientist at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, recently begrudgingly admitted, most people were trying to disprove this. Now they're going to have to realize there's some truth to it. But there cannot be just some truth to it. The Younger Dryas comet hypothesis is either right or wrong. My own assessment, having pored through more than 7 years of research papers, and having read every attack and refutation since the first public airing of the hypothesis in 2007, is that the case for the impact is a very strong one that grows stronger and more convincing every day. I could give many further examples of the successful efforts by the proponents of the hypothesis to defend their ideas over the years, but rather than doing so here, I refer the interested reader to the sources given in the footnote. Meanwhile, the September 2014 paper, summarizing the evidence presented, concludes. A cosmic impact event at the onset of the Younger Dryas cooling episode is the only hypothesis capable of explaining the simultaneous deposition of peak abundances in nanodiamonds, magnetic and glassy spherules, melt glass, platinum, and/or other proxies across at least four continents approaching 50 million square kilometers. The evidence strongly supports a cosmic impact 12,800 years ago. Of particular note, adds James Kennett, is the fact that the glassy and metallic materials in the YDB layers could only have formed at temperatures in excess of 2,200 degrees Celsius, and therefore could not have resulted from any alternative scenario other than a massive comet impact. The exact size of that impact remains to be resolved with further research. Until then, says Kennett, there is no known limit to the YDB Struan field, which currently covers more than 10% of the planet, indicating that the YDB event was a major cosmic impact. The nanodiamond datum recognized in this study gives scientists a snapshot of a moment in time called an isochron. Worldwide, to this day, scientists know of only two layers of sediment broadly distributed across several continents that exhibit coeval abundance peaks in a comprehensive assemblage of cosmic impact markers, including nanodiamonds, high-temperature quenched spherules, high-temperature melt glass, carbon spherules, iridium, and acidiform carbon. These layers are found at the Younger Dryas boundary 12,800 years ago, and at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary 65 million years ago, when it has long been agreed that a gigantic cosmic impact in the Gulf of Mexico, in that case the impactor is thought to have been an asteroid some 10 kilometers in diameter, caused the mass extinction of the dinosaurs. The evidence we present settles the debate about the existence of abundant YDB nanodiamonds, Kennett says. Our hypothesis challenges some existing paradigms within several disciplines, including impact dynamics, archaeology, paleontology, and paleoceanography, paleoclimatology, all affected by this relatively recent cosmic impact. The point Kennett makes here has important implications for the study and understanding of our past. Archaeologists have been in the habit of regarding cosmic impacts, supposedly only occurring at multi-million-year intervals, as largely irrelevant to the 200,000-year story of anatomically modern humans. When we believed that the last big impact had been the dinosaur-killing asteroid of 65 million years ago, there was obviously little point in trying to relate cosmic accidents on such an almost unimaginable scale in any way to the much shorter time frame of history. But the very real possibility, confirmed by Kennett's study, that a huge, earth-shaking, extinction-level event occurred just 12,800 years ago, in our historical backyard, changes everything.
Chapter 6. Fingerprints of a Comet. The evidence from deposits of nanodiamonds, microspherules, high-temperature melt glass, and other ET impact proxies at the Younger Dryas boundary points strongly towards a cataclysmic encounter between the Earth and a large comet around 12,800 years ago. The point of entry would have been somewhere over Canada, by which time the comet might already have broken up into multiple fragments on its journey through space, as was the case with comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 when its freight train of large fragments hit Jupiter with spectacular effect in 1994. It's equally possible, however, that the breakup of the Younger Dryas comet did not occur until after it had entered the Earth's atmosphere. Either way, some of the fragments very soon exploded in the air. Others, with diameters of up to 2 kilometers, smashed down at various points on the North American ice cap. Yet others streaked on in a southeasterly direction across the Atlantic Ocean, where further impacts followed on the European ice cap, and still others remained aloft until they reached the Middle East in the vicinity of Turkey, Lebanon, and Syria, where the final rain of impacts occurred. Because the evidence for the comet is so new, and because the impact hypothesis is still disputed, almost no consideration has yet been given to the immediate effects of the multiple major impacts that are thought to have taken place on the North American ice cap. In all cases, the ice itself, still more than 2 kilometers thick 12,800 years ago, would have absorbed most of the shock of the impact, leaving very few lasting features on the ground. Even so, researchers have begun to home in on a number of possible craters. One candidate is the so-called Charity Shoal feature in Lake Ontario, consisting of a raised rim around a small circular basin approximately a kilometer in diameter and 19 meters deep. It was studied by a team of scientists led by Troy Holcomb, who concluded that it was likely to be of extraterrestrial impact origin and might have been created in the late Pleistocene around the time of the onset of the Younger Dryas. Similarly, the half-kilometer diameter, 10-meter deep Bloody Creek structure in southwestern Nova Scotia was identified as a possible impact crater by Ian Spooner, George Stevens and others in a 2009 paper in the journal Meteoritics and Planetary Science. They couldn't be confident as to its age, but noted that impact onto glacier ice during the waning stages of the Wisconsin glaciation, about 12,000 years ago, may have resulted in dissipation of much impact energy into the ice, resulting in the present morphology of the Bloody Creek structure. A third candidate is the Corrosol crater in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, Canada. Discovered by the Canadian Hydrographic Service during underwater mapping, Corrosol is 4 kilometers in diameter, implying an impacting object with a diameter of up to half a kilometer. The crater presently lies in 40 to 185 meters of water and was originally thought to be very ancient, dating to some point after the Middle Ordovician about 470 million years ago. Recent research, however, casts doubt on this chronology. For example, M.D. Higgins and his colleagues from the University of Quebec and the Geological Survey of Canada argued in a paper presented at the 42nd Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in March 2011 that the paucity of sediments in the crater might be taken to indicate that it is young. The minimum age was established using data from a 7-meter core taken in the central trough. Calibrated carbon-14 ages of shells in the sediments can be extrapolated to give an estimate of the age of the base of the sedimentary sequence of around 12,900 years ago. This is taken to be the youngest possible age of the impact. That youngest possible age of 12,900 years is comfortably within the margin of error of 12,800 years plus or minus 150 years that is presently accepted for the Younger Dryas boundary. In other words, if the findings of Higgins and his team are confirmed, Corrosol could well be one of the hitherto missing impact craters left by the Younger Dryas comet. Firm identification of such a crater would be jam on the cake for Firestone, Kennett, West and other pro-impact scientists, but as they've made clear many times, they do not need craters to prove their hypothesis, since prominent craters are not to be expected either from airbursts or from impacts on ice caps. Nonetheless, Charity Shoal, Bloody Creek and Corrosol do not stand alone. A fourth possible impact site has been identified somewhat to the west of Corrosol, in an area known to geologists as the Quebecia Terrain. High concentrations of YDB microspherules found near the towns of Melrose in Pennsylvania and Newtonville in New Jersey were analyzed by Wu, Sharma, Lecomte, Dimitrov and Landis in a paper published in September 2013 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Their conclusion was that an impact on the Laurentide ice sheet penetrated to the bedrock of the Quebecia Terrain, throwing ejecta high into the atmosphere. The ejecta included spherules in the range of 2 to 5 millimeters in diameter that were spread by the winds and rained down hundreds of miles away in the Melrose-Newtonville area. Significantly, the spherules turned out on analysis to contain minerals such as suicite that form at temperatures in excess of 2,000 degrees centigrade. Gross texture, mineralogy, and the age of the spherules appear consistent with their formation as ejecta from an impact 12,900 years ago. The rare earth element patterns and the SR and ND isotopes of the spherules indicate that their source lies in the Quebecia Terrain. We have provided evidence for an impact on top of the ice sheet, concluded study co-author Mukul Sharma. We have, for the first time, narrowed down the region where a Younger Dryas impact did take place, even though we have not yet found its crater. Judging from the apparent northwest to southeast trajectory of the Younger Dryas comet, the Charity Shoal feature in Lake Ontario, ejecta from the Quebecia terrane, the Corusol crater in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and the Bloody Creek structure in Nova Scotia might mark the impacts of the last large fragments to hit North America. But the even larger fragments in the range of 2 kilometers in diameter that Firestone, Kennett and West envisage would inevitably have hit the ice cap earlier in the trajectory, and thus at points lying further to the north and west. It is to these hypothetical impacts on the western fringes of the Laurentide ice cap and on the Cordilleran ice cap that we should look for the possible source of the meltwater for Bretz's flood. Radical thinking. Although the notion of outburst floods from glacial Lake Missoula has long been accepted by mainstream science as the source of the spectacular flood damage documented by Bretz, it's important to recognize that a number of senior, highly credentialed scientists continue to dissent from this view. Prominent amongst the dissenters is John Shaw, professor of earth sciences at the University of Alberta in Canada. Shaw argues that the volume of water in Lake Missoula, estimated at around 2,000 cubic kilometers at its peak, is not sufficient to account for the field evidence. His own theory is that huge quantities of meltwater, of the order of 100,000 cubic kilometers, were impounded in a subglacial reservoir deep beneath the North American ice cap, and he proposes that the flood damage was caused by a single, massive release from this reservoir. Japanese researchers Goro Komatsu, Hideaki Miyamoto, Kazumasa Ito, and Hiroyuki Tosaka have carried out extensive computer simulations of large-scale cataclysmic floods across the Scablands, and agree with Shaw that glacial Lake Missoula was not, on its own, anywhere near large enough to account for the flood damage. Even the whole draining of Lake Missoula cannot explain the field evidence of high water marks. The subglacial flooding from the north proposed by Shaw may provide an explanation for the increased volume of water required to explain the high watermark evidence in the channeled scabland. Likewise, Victor Baker, professor of hydrology and water resources at the University of Arizona, and Jim O'Connor of the U.S. Geological Survey's Water Science Center have expressed concern about the case for periodic colossal joculaps out of glacial Lake Missoula. In our view, anomalies still exist between some aspects of the field evidence and the conceptual models that have been advocated. The position that the scores of floods hypothesis completes Bretz's imaginative theory may prematurely divert attention from some of the outstanding problems that remain in interpreting the spectacular features of the channeled scabland. In 1977, geologist C. Warren Hunt set out to conduct a detailed investigation into Bretz's flood. He did so because, like the scholars cited above, he was unconvinced by the theory, which had already assumed the status of unassailable fact by the mid-1970s, that all the water damage visible in the scablands had been caused by outburst floods from Lake Missoula. Hunt's dissatisfaction stemmed from his own extensive knowledge of dams and how to design them to take best advantage of local geology. The bottom line, according to his calculations, was that the proposed ice dam on the Clark Fork River, behind which Lake Missoula is supposed to have backed up, would have been, quite literally, impossible. Let us first of all consider the statistics. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, glacial Lake Missoula at its highest level, the level it is presumed to have reached before the Clark Fork ice dam broke, covered an area of about 3,000 square miles and contained an estimated 500 cubic miles, 2,084 cubic kilometers, of water. Its surface would have been at 4,150 feet above sea level, but the bottom terrain varied in altitude from point to point, so the USGS calculates that the lake would have been about 950 feet deep at present-day Missoula, 260 feet deep at Darby, and around 1,100 feet deep near Polson. At the ice dam itself, however, a gradient in the underlying terrain meant the glacial lake would have been more than 2,000 feet deep, its deepest point, more than twice the depth of modern Lake Superior. While broadly concurring with the U.S. Geological Survey's figures, C. Warren Hunt emphatically rejected the suggestion that ice might have dammed the Clark Fork so as to impound water to a depth of 2,100 feet. When one considers, he wrote, that modern engineering employs bedrock grouting for securing the footings of 500-foot dams, it must surely strike any reader as virtually frivolous to suggest that chance emplacement of glacial ice might have dammed Clark Fork across a 7-mile span, lacking in intermediate abutments, and then retained water at 4 times the pressure of modern engineered dams. Hunt's incredulity at the notion of an ice dam more than 2,000 feet high and 7 miles long receives support from studies which argue that at a lake depth of approximately 200 meters, 656 feet, the hydrostatic pressure exerted on the damming ice is sufficient to begin to force a hole through the ice. Once formed, this hole will enlarge by frictional melt widening, enabling the drainage of ice-dammed lake water to occur. At more than thrice 200 meters in height, therefore, the hypothetical Clark Fork ice dam does indeed begin to look impossible. Yet, as noted, Hunt accepted the USGS statistics. The surface of Lake Missoula certainly did at one point stand 4,150 feet above sea level, and the lake therefore must indeed have reached around 2,100 feet deep in the Clark Fork Valley between the Bitterroot and Cabinet mountain ranges. That it did so is confirmed by an ancient strand line at that altitude, and other strand lines have been found at lower altitudes, which clearly show many subsequent lower water levels after the high one. Hunt's solution, however, since he continued to regard the Clark Fork Dam as a geological impossibility, was to propose that a gigantic flood, thousands of feet deep, must have washed over the entire region at the end of the Ice Age, in the process filling the various basins of glacial Lake Missoula up to the 4,150-foot level where the highest strand line is found, and leaving the lower strand lines as it receded. As the source of his proposed region-wide flood, Hunt suggested that tidal inundation, brought on by some form of gravitational attraction from a celestial source, the nature of which is beyond the competence of the writer, must have resulted in a tide rising to 5,000 feet, 1,600 meters, above present sea level. The waters were held there for several weeks, during which there was much surging, partial floating of glaciers, and development of the highest beaches in Lake Missoula. The tidal ebb and flood with successive lower beaches developed, allowing sweeping of the canyons, removal of previous glacial deposits, fans and talus, scouring the scablands, ice rafting, polishing of standing rock obstructions to tidal surge, aggradation of valley and bypass floors, and discharge of boulders into submarine deltas and fans. Lastly, a layer of silt was left in the wake of the tide, especially in the quieter waters of cul-de-sac estuaries. In other words, Hunt had very much gone back to Bretz in proposing a single gigantic flood as the source of all the damage on the Columbia Plateau. His 1977 notion that it was a tidal inundation of seawater rushing up estuaries and brought on by the gravitational attraction of some hypothetical celestial body is, however, untenable, and Hunt himself recognized this when he revisited the subject some years later in his 1990 book, Environment of Violence. Conceding that the tidewater solution is weakened by the great distance to tidewater and the absence of a trail of evidence along the possible routes, he sought out other possible sources of water in sufficiently vast quantities to inflict the damage to the landscape that he had observed in the field. In the process, he briefly considered John Shaw's theory of a subglacial reservoir of 100,000 cubic kilometers of meltwater, but asked some pertinent questions. How could such melting take place without a heat source such as the volcanic heat, which precipitates Icelandic jökulsárs? What climatic regimen would allow such melting in the first place? Why would the water not have lifted the periphery of the ice sheet and emerged without accumulating soon after it was produced by melting? What containment mechanism would allow accumulation of a great under-ice lake beneath 3,000 meters of ice? And would not water beneath the maximum ice thickness tend to escape towards the lesser confining pressures under peripheral areas of the ice sheet? Is there any possible way such a huge under-ice chamber of water could accumulate? To cut a long story short, Hunt reasoned that there was not. Besides, the 100,000 cubic kilometers that Shaw's theory offered was, in his opinion, insufficient. Almost 10 times as much water would be needed to account for all the field evidence. With a tidal source, glacial Lake Missoula, and Shaw's under-ice reservoir all dismissed, therefore, Hunt found himself left with only one possible, though startlingly catastrophist, solution. Somehow, in some way, very rapid cataclysmic melting of an immense area of the North American ice cap must have taken place. After doing the necessary calculations, Hunt concluded that 840,000 cubic kilometers of ice, in other words, about 10% of the entire glaciated area, would have had to melt. The reader will recall that Bretz originally envisaged something similar, but was defeated by the inability of either radical global warming or subglacial volcanism, quite simply neither happened, to account for the vast quantities of meltwater his flood called for. In the end, as we saw, he settled for outburst floods from glacial Lake Missoula as the answer. In 1990, Hunt faced the same dilemma, with the exception that he'd already ruled out Lake Missoula, but showed himself to be an extraordinarily competent and prescient innovator when, without any preamble, he wrote, "Earth heat cannot have melted continental ice to produce floodwaters in the volumes required. A cometary heat source could have served the purpose." To melt 10% of the North American ice cap, Hunt calculated that the kinetic energy of a half-kilometer diameter comet would be sufficient. A comet of the type that exploded above the Tunguska site in 1908 could have provided this heat. The Great Lake it might have created in the middle of the ice sheet would rapidly have tunneled under the remaining glacier and emerged as catastrophic floods in many directions. Cometary melting of the ice seems necessary to yield so much water in such a short time. Anticipating the objection that no crater had been found, Hunt pointed out that the Tunguska event, an airburst, likewise left no crater or ejecta blanket. Furthermore, in the case of a hypothetical comet impact on the North American ice cap, all ejecta and cometary matter would likely have been swept away in the ensuing flood, coming to rest widely dispersed in the drift blanket far from its source. Thus diluted and mixed with other debris, direct evidence for either the exploded projectile or ejecta from the site could be difficult to recognize if not lost to science permanently. Last but not least, and again the prescience is almost eerie, Hunt noted that glass spherules, if found in glacial debris, could support the theory. He could not have known then, writing a quarter of a century ago, that from 2007 onwards a team of leading scientists would champion the cause of comet impacts on the North American ice cap, and in the absence of obvious craters, would derive much of their evidence from microspherules, fused glass, and nanodiamonds. How to change global climate in an instant. Hunt's suggestion was that a single, relatively small, half-kilometer diameter object would have packed sufficient kinetic energy to set off the melting of approximately one-tenth of the North American ice cap, producing a cataclysmic flood. 25 years on, the proponents of the Younger-Dryas comet hypothesis, as we've seen, are proposing that multiple 2-kilometer objects may have impacted the ice cap. If they're correct, the scale of the ensuing floods must have been almost unimaginably large, nor would they have been confined only to the channeled scablands of the Columbia Plateau. The comet hypothesis envisages a rain of impacts right across the ice sheet from the Pacific to the Atlantic coasts of North America, so we should find evidence of flooding everywhere. We do. The Columbia Plateau displays flood-ravaged scablands, but so too does the state of New Jersey much further to the east. The Columbia Plateau is notable for its fields and hillsides strewn with huge ice-rafted erratics, but so too is the state of New York. Indeed, perched on the bare rock surfaces of Manhattan's Central Park are many imposing erratic boulders, including diabase from the Palisades Sill along the Hudson River and schist from even further afield. Interestingly, too, just as the Columbia Plateau has its coulees, so New York State has its Finger Lakes. These latter were long thought to have been carved by glaciers, but their geomorphology closely parallels that of the coulees, and some researchers now believe they were cut by glacial meltwater at extreme pressures, a process linked by sediment evidence to the collapse of continental ice sheets. Likewise, in Minnesota, on the St. Croix River, where Randall Carlson and I finished our long road trip across North America, there is a spectacular array of more than 80 giant glacial potholes. One is 10 feet wide and 60 feet deep, making it the deepest explored pothole in the world. Others as yet unexcavated are even wider, suggesting the probability that they may be deeper as well. And all of them, without exception, were carved out by turbulent floods at the end of the Ice Age, floods emanating, Randall believes, from the superior lobe of the Laurentide ice cap. You could spend a lifetime, he tells me, traveling this land and still not see it all. The effects of megascale flood flows have been extensively documented in the eastern foothills of the Rocky Mountains, in both Canada and the US, across the prairie states, in the vicinity of the Great Lakes, in Pennsylvania and western New York, and in New England. All the Canadian provinces preserve large-scale evidence of gigantic water flows. All regions within or proximal to the area of the last great glaciation show the effects of intense, mega-scale floods. But the question that remains concerns the source of these floods. Having been dragged, kicking and screaming into conceding that flooding occurred at all, gradualist science, as we have seen, subsequently engaged in a love affair with glacial Lake Missoula, elevating it and its epic joculopes to serve as the sole explanation for all the astonishing diluvial features of the channeled scablands of the Columbia Plateau. It is not surprising, therefore, that other Ice Age floods, wherever they're admitted to have occurred, are also attributed to joculopes from glacial lakes. More than that, it is the floodwaters from these glacial lakes, rather than anything so vulgarly catastrophist as a comet, that are presently regarded by mainstream science as the most likely cause of the Younger Dryas cold event. The giant glacial lake Agassiz, which lay across most of Manitoba, northwestern Ontario, northern Minnesota, eastern North Dakota, and Saskatchewan, is particularly implicated. Around 13,000 years ago, that is, immediately before the onset of the Younger Dryas, Lake Agassiz is thought to have covered an area as great as 440,000 square kilometers, 170,000 square miles, when an ice dam broke and allowed a substantial fraction of its contents, perhaps as much as 9,500 cubic kilometers, to spill out along a flood path running through the Mackenzie River system in the Canadian Arctic coastal plain, and thence into the Arctic Ocean. There, the anticyclonic circulation of a current known as the Beaufort Gyre would have gradually moved it onwards into the subpolar North Atlantic in the transpolar drift. The slow release of meltwater through Fram Strait provides a mechanism unique to the Arctic that is capable of turning a short-duration, high-magnitude meltwater discharge into a significantly longer, more moderated and sustained meltwater rerouting event to the North Atlantic. What made matters worse, however, was that at the same time, huge quantities of icy meltwater were also being dumped into the North Atlantic from the other glacial lakes and directly off the Laurentide ice sheet itself. The combined effect, so the theory goes, disrupted ocean circulation to such an extent that it radically affected global climate. A great gush of cold fresh water, derived from the melting Laurentide ice sheet, swept across the surface of the North Atlantic. It prevented warm, salty water from the Southern Ocean flowing deep beneath the surface, the Gulf Stream, from rising to the surface. The normal overturning of the ocean water stopped. As a consequence, the atmosphere over the ocean, which would normally have been warmed, remained cold, and so in consequence did the air over Europe and North America. These are highly technical matters, with which we do not need to concern ourselves at too great length here. In brief, though, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, also known as the thermohaline circulation, is the great ocean conveyor belt that not only carries warm, salty equatorial water to the surface and thence northwards, where it eventually cools and sinks off the coasts of Greenland and Norway, but also carries the resultant cold North Atlantic deep water south, returning it slowly to the equator, where it mixes with warmer water, rises again to the surface, and thus continues the cycle. It transports large amounts of water, heat, salt, carbon, nutrients and other substances around the globe, and connects the surface ocean and atmosphere with the huge reservoir of the deep sea. As such, it is of critical importance to the global climate system. It was the shutting down of this delicately balanced, intricately interconnected, hugely complex, critical cycle, scientists agree, that caused the dramatic global cooling of the Younger Dryas. That the shutdown was the result of colossal meltwater floods out of glacial lakes and directly off the Laurentide ice cap is also agreed. A major puzzle, however, as S.J. Fidel points out in a keynote paper in the journal Quaternary International, is why this should have happened 12,800 years ago, rather than, say, 800 or 1,000 years earlier, at the height of the warm phase, known as the Bolling-Alerod interstadial, that immediately preceded the Younger Dryas. Intuitively, one feels the meltwater floods should have been at their peak during the warming phase. In reality, however, it was only at the Bolling-Alerod-Younger Dryas boundary that the meltwater releases occurred. The solution to the mystery seems transparently obvious to Richard Firestone, Alan West, Jim Kennett, and other proponents of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. Quite simply, there is no mystery. In their reckoning, the huge meltwater floods that so radically affected global climate were caused by multiple large fragments of a comet ripping through the Earth's atmosphere and smashing down into the ice cap. Not just one fragment of half a kilometer or so as envisaged by Seawar and Hunt, but as many as 8 fragments, and possibly more, including some that might have been as much as 2 kilometers in diameter. The colossal heat generated by such impacts, with a combined explosive power estimated, as we've seen, at 10 million megatons, provides all the energy needed to set off a truly cataclysmic meltdown of huge sectors of the North American ice cap. The gigantic flood that would have followed, after scouring the land in its path, would indeed have entered the oceans as a great gush of fresh water, and provided the shock to the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation that kept global climate savagely cold for the next 1,200 years. The situation would have been worsened by the injection of dust and immense quantities of smoke into the upper atmosphere, blocking sunlight for an extended period of time, which would, of course, have had the effect of lowering temperatures even further. Moreover, the impact event, followed by extensive fires and sudden climate change, likely contributed together to the rapid extinction of the megafauna and many other animals. The reader will recall that no less than 35 genera of North American mammals became extinct during the Younger Dryas. We are therefore, by definition, looking for an extinction mechanism that is capable of wiping out up to 35 genera across a continent in a geologic instant. Nor is it just North America that we must consider, for most of the diverse megafauna of South America that had flourished before the Younger Dryas also suffered extinction by 12,000 years ago, in other words, before the Younger Dryas came to an end. Could it have been overkill by human hunters? The question touches upon a contentious issue, namely, when in fact and from where did human beings first arrive in the Americas? Whatever the answer, it seems implausible that bands of nomadic hunter-gatherers would have been either motivated or ruthlessly efficient enough to wipe out so many animals, including giants like the Columbian mammoth, in so short a time, across 2 continents. Moreover, there is much to suggest that human beings in the Americas themselves entered a period of deep distress during the Younger Dryas that would have further reduced their motivation and efficiency. Archaeological evidence from South America is limited, but in North America, this was the time when the Clovis culture, with its sophisticated stone weapons technology, abruptly vanished from the record. Indeed, all available indicators point to a significant decline and/or reorganization in human population during the early centuries of the Younger Dryas. Once again, therefore, the only explanation that makes complete sense of the evidence is the comet impact hypothesis of Firestone, Kennett, West, and their large group of colleagues and co-authors. In the light of their findings, which we've reviewed extensively in the preceding chapters, I propose the following. 1. There was indeed cataclysmic flooding in North America at the end of the Ice Age. 2. It was not primarily caused by outburst floods from glacial lakes, but rather by the rapid, almost instantaneous meltdown of a large area of the ice cap. 3. The heat source needed to initiate this meltdown came from the kinetic energy of a series of impacts from fragments of a giant comet that entered the Earth's atmosphere over North America 12,800 years ago and bombarded the North American ice cap. 4. North America, while being the epicenter of the disaster, was by no means the only region hit. Other fragments of the disintegrating comet, including some particularly